Good morning. We were going to hear three cases today, and we will start with United States versus Isles. Mr. Cooper?
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. My name is Anthony Kichor, and I represent the appellant, Ketisha Isles. Before we start, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Granted.
The principal issue of this matter is that the District Court of the Virgin Islands failed to consider a request for departure at sentencing. This court has established a three-step process for sentencing, and this court said that this step would be followed in a separate and a sequential order, and would be done independent.
But counsel, here we there was not an objection below, so you agree we're reviewing for plain error, correct?
Yes.
And given that, what do we do with the statements that appear in your brief and in your reply? In the brief, you say that the district court, quote, indicated that a departure had already been factored in by not applying the two-level enhancement for non-loss. And in your reply, that it is clear that the district court was referencing Isles' requested downward departure and not a variance. In light of those characterizations of what the district court did, which indicated it wouldn't otherwise change its sentence, how do you get past, with plain error, that it affected substantial rights?
Judge Cross, what the district court did was they viewed an enhancement as a departure, which is two separate things. When Judge Finch said that he already gave the two points reduction, that was a reference to step one, which is according the step goes that you have to calculate the offense level, including any enhancements. The government wanted a two level enhancement. The government failed to prove. Justify a two-level enhancement. Therefore, the district court denied a two-level enhancement. Therefore, from 29 to 27, that was a level enhancement. Now,
how is that consistent with your statement in your briefing that the district court was referencing Isles' requested downward departure and not a variance?
Judge, I will say that after reviewing the case and doing the transcripts and everything, it shows that the district court combines steps one and step two. In other words, the district court, based on the precedent, was supposed to say, I accept that they have reviewed or they have made a consideration of the departure request, which it did not.
But let's look at the joint appendix, page 1086. And didn't you actually concede that when the court said at line 24 there, as I look at the statute, I recognize that I had the authority to vary your sentence, but I declined to do so, having already in my initial calculation decreased it by two levels. Didn't you concede that the court meant to say authority to depart?
You mean the expression, authority to depart?
Didn't you make that concession that they meant to say authority to depart there?
Yes, Judge, I do admit my error.
What's that?
I do admit my error.
That was your error?
So
you're confessing error.
Confessing.
All right. That's another concession.
I'll make errors. But Judge, what I'm saying is that, as I said in the reply brief, the judgment was issued quickly and succinctly and were also proportional. It's when I went back and had a chance to review the transcript, that's why I didn't notice that the procedural error.
Saying we agree with you that it was procedural error, but on a plain error review, you still have to persuade us that substantial rights were affected. That is, that there's substantial reason to think that the district court here on resentencing would come to a different result. What are you pointing to? What basis do you have, given that these issues, the defense that duress coercion was already rejected by the jury, the motion was clearly in front of the district court, was raised both in papers and in argument at sentencing, and your own acknowledgement that although the district court said variance, it appears it meant to say departure. How would it make any difference, even if we accept there was error here, to send it back for resentencing?
Judge Krause, as the rule says, it is a two-step process. The court failed to indicate on the record that they heard arguments for departure, it was considered, and you voted and decided not to grant it. Rather, the district court said that I already gave a 2-point reduction, which was an enhancement. That's different from a departure. So,
you know, I have been a district judge, and I recall sitting on the bench sentencing, and sometimes things go around you very quickly. And for that reason, this court has said that often there are no magic words, there's no magic formula you have to follow. If it becomes clear from what occurred in the courtroom that the judge, although the exact words weren't used, and perhaps the most correct word wasn't used, that the judge did consider the request for departure and in the sentence given, denied it. Isn't that also consistent with Third Circuit precedent?
Well, Judge Roth, the judge didn't say that I considered the departure for the rest and coercion. The judge just said that I already granted
a lessening of the sentence and I'm not going to grant any more.
Yes.
And doesn't that implicitly say I'm denying the request for departure?
I would say no, Judge. Because the enhancement is different from a departure.
Yeah, but you know, when you're a district judge sitting up there, sometimes you can't remember sometimes when you're an appellate judge too, which is an enhancement and which is a departure, and how they come in the order. And you're trying to explain to the defendant in the district court that you recognize there's a request for departure, but you've already lessened the penalty and you don't think it's appropriate to lessen it, to lower it any further.
It's judges who make errors, so do attorneys. But Judge Rob, the judge did not say, this is my ruling on the record and motion for the downward departure. The judge just said, reduced the enhancement, which was an enhancement. It's supposed to be done separately and sequentially. You make a ruling on the offense level, including the enhancement, then the next level, you consider motions for departure.
Counsel, I think we understand your argument on that issue. With your remaining time, would you like to address the suppression issue?
Yes, Judge. At trial, the district court also failed to suppress the evidence. Ms. Isles was, for all intents and purposes, in custody.
What was that? Say that again.
Oh, sorry. For all intents and purposes, Ms. Isles was in custody before she gave the evidence.
But why was she in custody? Tell us what your argument is that she was in custody. There's a recent case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Michigan versus House, and I was always surprised by the outcome of that case. I figured if Mr. House wasn't in custody, it'd be pretty hard to be in custody when you looked at the totality of the circumstances.
Well, And exactly, Judge, look at it by the circumstances. Ms. Adams was stopped, was tried to stop by police officers. She was told to go to the Rainbow Station, which is the police department. She was there from before 5 o'clock until 9 o'clock. She gave the sign waiver at 7:59. So before that, before 5 and 7:59, she was in custody. She wasn't free to leave.
Now, isn't there a dispute? The government claims that she was not questioned for more than 45 minutes.
Yes, Judge Rush. Well, if you look at the record, the waiver was signed at 7:59. The videotape ended at 9:09 p.m. So therefore, it was an hour and 10 minutes. That's more than the 45 minutes. Then if you take into consideration that Ms. Isles was carried or told to the person before 5 o'clock, so she was in custody before 5 until 9.
But didn't they tell her she was free to leave?
The record?
I mean, they asked her, they invited her to come to the police station. And she drove to the police station by herself. And then her mother and her stepfather arrived at the police station. Did they ever tell her that she wasn't free to leave? I think they told her initially, she didn't, you know, they invited her, you could leave.
Didn't she meet with her mother?
Soon Judge Ross.
Didn't, during this period of time, wasn't she allowed to meet with her mother and talk with her mother?
Briefly, but Judge Ross, while she was there, she was detained. And you look at the totality of Ms. L's circumstances, her mental state. To her, she was detained. She wasn't free to leave. She had to stay there and answer the question.
But is detention a subjective state or an objective state?
Judge Roth, I'll say it's both. And not to be clear, but I'll say to Ms. Isles, she was detained. She had no fear. She couldn't tell the police officer, "Oh, I don't want to go to the station." She followed. When she was at the station, even though the cell door was open or the website was unlocked, she couldn't just get up and say, "I'm leaving." She wasn't told, there's no question, Ms. I was told that you need to get an attorney. You're free to leave. You could just get up and leave. You could always end this question, this kind of question. It wasn't until 7:59 that's when Ms. Lyles signed the waiver.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from you again on rebuttal. For the government, Ms. Williams Henry.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Robert Williams Henry on behalf of the United States. The district court did not review any evidence in this case as before this panel. With respect to the issue of custody, the court considers several factors when determining whether or not the defendant is in custody. With respect to the custody issue, the court looks at several factors to determine whether or not a defendant is in custody. Those factors consist of the following: the location of the questioning, what the officers knew concerning the suspect's culpability, whether the officers revealed their belief that the suspect was guilty.
Here, don't we have many of those factors satisfied? After all, this was a station house interrogation, and we have said those should be scrutinized with special care.
Correct.
And the Detective Cruz admitted that he never told her that she was free to leave. In fact, he suspected her of being involved, and he told her that he saw her on the surveillance video.
Correct.
Aren't those all circumstances that create the kind of coercive atmosphere that would lead a reasonable person to conclude they were not free to leave?
They would be, Your Honor, but the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances. Not one factor is dispositive, which the district court did in this case. The district court looked at the several factors and apply the facts to those particular factors in this case. For instance, Judge, with respect to the voluntariness of the questioning, the court found that the defendant went down there on her own free will. When Detective Cruz was called to the scene...
Let me ask you about that, her going on her own free will. I find it... of course, this is a small island in relation to, you know, the scope of things, particularly to the mainland. They knew this car. I mean, it was nothing unusual about this car, but they saw the car, and they saw Miss Isles in the car. I mean, it seems to me that the knowledge that everybody has about the residents here is makes it a special circumstance. I mean, they knew who this car, they knew who this person was. They had seen her on the video, and they told her to come to the police station. And she knew she couldn't run and hide, apparently, because she was known, her car was known.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, the report reflects that once Detective Cruz got to her vehicle, he introduced himself and he asked her to come down to the station. And he left. He didn't know if she would follow or not, and she did. Now, the court looked at those circumstances and determined that the defendant was unescorted. She went unescorted. Cruz left. He didn't know whether she was coming or not. As a matter of fact, when Cruz was in the station, he mentioned to the detective that his partner during the interview that a female may be coming. So he wasn't sure that she would come or not. The defendant was free to go or not.
You keep pointing us to the district court's balancing of these factors.
I'm sorry?
You are pointing us back to the district court's weighing of these different factors. But the question of whether someone is in custody is a legal question. Aren't we reviewing that de novo?
That's the legal question, yes. But for the factual issues, the court has to look at a clear error. But yes, the legal questions are de novo.
So taking account of the facts and the number of circumstances that weigh in favor of custody, couldn't we come to a different conclusion as to whether Ms. Isles was in custody?
But this suppression issue deals with the facts, Your Honor. And if the district court's account of the facts of the evidence is plausible, like the record in total, then the Court of Appeals may not reverse, even though had this court been sitting in that case, they would weigh the evidence differently. So with respect to the facts, it's clear error, it's a high burden. The district court judge was there to witness the demeanor of the witnesses, to hear the testimony, and to decide the case. So this clear error standard with respect to the facts is a high burden. And with respect to the district court finding of the defendant not in custody, there was no error, and we would ask that the judgment with respect to the suppression should be affirmed.
Suppose that we felt that she was in custody, and that the statement should be suppressed. Was there enough other evidence in the record to convict her, to uphold the jury verdict?
Is the court asking if the defendant did not give the statement, would there be additional...
If the statement was... if we found the statement was not admissible, was there enough other evidence to support the jury verdict?
The court had the surveillance videos that showed the defendant in the area at the time of the robbery. So there's that, Your Honor.
Was there an identification?
An identification was made from the store owner. The store owner identified the appellant as the individual who went into the store, the first time she walked around, they asked her if she needed help, and she said she didn't need any help, so she left. And then when she came back and they brought her in, she held the door open, and the store owner identified her as that person. Yes.
Did he identify her in the courtroom or identify her in the video?
He identified her in the courtroom.
Even if we concluded that she was in custody, I think the government's also arguing that there would not be a Siebert violation.
Absolutely not, Judge. Not in this case.
Can you address that issue? Because given the way we think of what constitutes an incriminating statement, for example, when someone invokes the Fifth in response to a grand jury subpoena, as long as it's evidence that in a chain of evidence could lead to other incrimination, we take that as satisfying the threshold of what constitutes an incriminating statement. Why wouldn't we apply that here so that even her initial statement, acknowledging that she was present, would constitute an incriminating statement for purposes of a pre-Miranda admission, and thus a Siebert violation if she was then in custody?
Well, in Siebert, Your Honor, the defendant was arrested initially. She was arrested, and the officer spoke to her, and she gave the incriminating statement. Then the Mirandized her, and then she repeated the incriminating statement. Those facts are not present in this case. In this case, when Detective Cruz first talked to the appellant, she denied having anything to do with it.
But she acknowledged that she was present. And why isn't that in the chain of inferences, the chain of pieces of evidence that could constitute a full confession? Why wouldn't that be enough to trigger the same concerns that animate Siebert?
Because saying that, because if she said she was present, that it doesn't say the part that she played. And we know the part that she played was to hold the door open for those individuals. So just saying that I was present, it is not incriminating on the space. She could just have been there by happenstance. We know that's not the case.
She could have, but any time a suspect acknowledges that they were present at the scene of the crime, isn't that on its face incriminating?
Well, in this case, the appellant said that she was present and that some individuals came in and robbed and they left. There's no indication of the role that she played.
Does Siebert require that the entire confession be given before Miranda warnings, or only that some incriminating statement be made that then opens the door to giving a further statement after Miranda has been given?
It requires an incriminating statement be made.
And why isn't acknowledging a suspect's presence at the scene of a crime incriminating?
Because acknowledging presence without more is, I'm not sure that rises to the level of incrimination. As I said, that it could just be happenstance that, it could have been happenstance that the defendant.
Had Detective Cruz already, excuse me, informed her that she was on the surveillance, the video of the store?
When she was in the station, yes, he had told her why he wanted to talk to her, correct?
She had shown up on the video.
Correct.
On the sentencing question for a moment, you argue in your brief that a variance was not even on the table in this case, but yet how should we interpret your lengthy argument in your sentencing memorandum that a 3553 variance was not warranted? That seems contrary to your argument here.
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
Well, was there a variance on the table or was there not a variance?
No, there was no variance on the table, Your Honor.
Well, why did you spend, why did you have your lengthy argument in your sentencing memo on arguing against the variance if it wasn't on the table?
That is the sentencing memo that is required to be filed.
That's what?
That is the sentencing memo that is required to be filed in our district.
So it was boilerplate maybe and not
yes, Your Honor.
Relevant?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Required to be filed by whom?
That is our stock sentencing memo that's filed with the court.
Okay.
It addresses departures and
so in essence, your argument is that the variance was never in front of the court.
No,
that the debate was always about a departure, and as I read in the one section of the appendix, the court just misspoke when it said vary instead of depart.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. If we were to take that rule, what would that do to our precedent that says a district court's discussion at the variance stage does not necessarily shed light on what would be done at the departure stage, and the need to consider all the 3553A factors is frustrated when a sentencing court fails to expressly rule on the merits of a departure motion?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, the district court judge did not specifically say, I decline to depart. But if the court looks at the steps at sentencing, the district court did engage in all three steps at the sentencing. The court did calculate the guidelines. And it was while the government was giving its allocution, that's when the district court said that it doesn't agree with the two-level enhancement. And so we already knew that, we already acknowledged that the sentencing guideline range, the level was 29. And with him stating that he did not agree with the two-level enhancement, that brought it up to 27. So the court did engage in the calculation of the guidelines.
But the court did not rule, at least expressly, on the departure motion. Isn't that a problem? I mean, your argument seems to be, yes, but the court acknowledged its authority to vary. But our case law says that acknowledging authority to vary does not answer the question of whether a district court would have departed if it recognized the motion or recognized its authority to depart. How can we be assured here that the district court would have imposed the same sentence if not for this error when the district court didn't even acknowledge the motion?
Well, Your Honor, the district court had the sentence in memorandum from the appellant, and it had the government's sentence in memorandum where it opposed the departure that was requested.
Doesn't that make the error in the court not addressing it all the more plain?
But our position is that the court did address it. The court stated that he was aware of his authority to use vary, but he declined to do so. Those the sentencing memos were before the court. So the government's position is that he did not say, I am going to deny your motion to depart. The fact that he was aware of it and declined to depart is him basically addressing the departure motion, right?
Right. I think I understand your argument. Thank you very much.
I will ask that the court affirm the judgment.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, and we'll hear back from Mr. Court. Mr. Couture, could we start with the question of the Siebert violation? That is, how is it an incriminating statement to acknowledge presence when Officer Cruz had already advised her that they saw her on video, they knew she was present?
Can you repeat that question again?
Yes. So for the Siebert violation on which she based her suppression argument, She needed to make an incriminating statement before she was given Miranda warnings. The incriminating statement she appears to have made, if it was one, was simply the acknowledgement that she was present. But since the officers had advised her that they saw her on video and were asking her about her presence, why would it be incriminating to acknowledge that she was in fact present?
Is that incriminating, Judge Krause? As Judge Fisher said, I'm sure we're talking about the video, and just because she was in the store and she was present doesn't mean that she was a part of the robbery. She was present. If there were a lot of shoppers there, would it also be, and they said that they would be, would Detective Tool said that they incriminated themselves?
So your position is that her statement acknowledging that she was present was not an incriminating statement?
It was not for the purpose she was there. Detective Cruz stopped her and started. Two police officers stopped Ms. Wells. Detective Cruz came and he said, follow me, come to Rainbow. As Judge Richard said, it's a small man. There's no way she could have gone. She had to go to the Rainbow station.
I'm not asking about whether she was in custody or not. I'm asking about whether the statement that was made before formal Miranda warnings, whether you're contending that was an incriminating statement. Is it your position that her acknowledgement that she was present, her statement at the station house that she was present, was non-incriminating?
It's not for it. It's incriminating. Non-incriminating.
Is it your position that was non-incriminating?
Yes, that's right.
If that's so, how is there any Siebert violation? Doesn't Siebert require an incriminating statement before Miranda warnings, with a confession then repeated afterwards?
Yes, Judge, I think you said it was incriminating as procedure. It was not, or I didn't hear correctly. But Judge Cross, the statement that she made saying that she was there, it was incriminating the statement.
You can complete your answer.
The statement that was made by Ms. Isles before this 159, before she made the video confession, Ms. Isles she didn't know what she was doing. She did not knowingly or voluntarily know what she was saying. The reason she went to the police station, she wasn't told that we went to the police station because we think you are a suspect.
I think we understand the custody argument. Do you have any final questions? Then we'll thank both counsel for their argument today. And we'll take the case under advisement.